Good evening and happy holidays to all of our Obituary listeners and supporters and friends. And, well, if you're tuning into this, good evening to you and happy holidays. We are doing two holiday episodes this year, which is pretty standard for us. We usually do two, at least, episodes in December, both with sort of a winter holiday theme. This year, we are doing the same. We're going to have our regular Yuletide cheer episode, which will be largely music, and then maybe a little bit of us in between the music for you to enjoy. And then we are also doing this episode. This episode is Yuletide Fear. So there's this whole old tradition of the idea of, you know, if you've heard the song, the scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago. Ghost stories have been a part of Christmas tradition for a long time. And even when ghost stories were not necessarily a part of Christmas tradition, there have always been these sort of scary parts of the holiday season that float around. It's winter. The nights are longer. There's a lot more darkness. So it makes a lot of sense that you would have a lot more inclination to tell scary stories, to do spooky things. The shadows are longer. The shadows linger later. And they come out earlier. So there's definitely this feeling in the air that while the season can be a season of light, can be a season of renewal, rebirth, joy, sharing warmth and happiness with loved ones, there's always that flip side, of course, to anything. And the flip side to the Yuletide season is the idea of things that scare you, things that go bump in the night. To that end, we have a special today that is nice and jammed-packed, full of different spooky elements. We've got a couple of ghost stories that you'll hear, and then in between those two, you will hear an interview with Al Ridenour, who has recently written a wonderful and fairly broad and inclusive account of the Krampus figure in folklore and performance and things like that, and the different sort of Krampus festivals, particularly those in Europe, although he does also get into American festivals as well. But he traces it through sort of the church history, some of its mythic origins and things like that. It's a great book. The interview is also quite excellent. He was a fun guest, even though he was battling with some laryngitis during the recording. You can hear him very clearly. He's fantastic. He's very articulate, and he explains some of the concepts in this book incredibly well. So I think you'll really, really enjoy that. At any rate, that is what we've got in this episode. We'll begin with a ghost story located somewhat near where I currently live. It's going to be based in Pennsylvania. And then we'll have the interview, and then we'll close out with another ghost story, and then I'll come back and bid you all whole farewell and good night. So, without any further ado, let's hop into it and have a wonderful and fearful little holiday special. The Toy Room, a ghost story of Allentown, Pennsylvania, adapted from S.E. Schlosser's Spooky Pennsylvania. The old couple had always wanted to live in the beautiful Victorian-style home, and were thrilled when an old house went on the market in their hometown. It had been built in the mid-1800s and had remained in the family of the builder for several generations, but now the owners were selling. The house was right in the couple's price range, too, and as the wife said, they might never get another chance like this, so they put in a bid on the house and were thrilled when it was quickly accepted. While they were closing on the house, the wife jokingly asked if the house had a ghost. The owner, an elderly woman, smiled and said that the ghost had never bothered her, but there was a sad death associated with the house. One summer day, the woman told them, around 100 years ago, the family dog had leapt off the porch and into the yard in pursuit of a neighbor's cat. The little girl had pursued immediately, intent on saving the poor cat, and had tripped over a small wire fence that surrounded her mother's peony plant in the front yard. The rusty metal wire had punctured her bare right foot, causing a small wound. Thinking nothing of it, the girl had captured the little dog and gone back to her play. But she soon developed tetanus, and the poor girl had died in the upstairs room that was now used as a bathroom. After they closed on the house, the couple moved in immediately. They were pleased with their new home. It had a large attic, a wonderful crooked staircase. The front stairs led to a wide open area where one could reach the three bedrooms and the bath. The downstairs had a huge kitchen, a beautiful dining room, two spacious parlors. As is always the case in an old house, there were many things that needed to be updated or replaced. The roof needed repairs, the plumbing was out of date, the radiators did not always function correctly. They concentrated on the plumbing, believing that the radiators could wait until fall when they would first need them. The wife scoured local flea markets for antiques and other items with which to fill every nook and cranny in traditional Victorian style. And over the summer, as she transformed the old house into a home, odd things began to occur. Items were moved or knocked over when nobody was home. The radiators in the upstairs bathroom in the spacious hallway upstairs began to make loud thumping sounds in the middle of the night, even though the furnace remained off. It sounded as if someone were banging their fist against the metal in anger. Then, the unwound ornamental clocks in the upstairs bedroom began to toll in the middle of the night. The clocks would strike 7 times in a row, and then cease as abruptly as they'd started. The husband slept peacefully through the nightly racket, but the wife started awake each time the radiator thumped or the unwound clocks rang. The activity seemed to center around the bathroom and the hallway. Sometimes the wife would come out of their bedroom and turn on the lights to see if she could find a cause for the noise, but no one was there. Then an icy chill began to appear in the bathroom, causing the wife to shiver every time she entered. She remembered the story of the little girl who had lived and died in that very room. Was this child come back to haunt her old home? Was she unhappy because strangers, not members of the family, now lived in her house? Putting aside all thoughts of fear, the wife began to transform the spacious upper hallway into a toy room for her grandchildren. She lined the walls and cases and filled them with dolls, books, soft toys, plush animals. She put a rocking horse in the corner and set up a little tea table with a tea set and chairs in the center of the hall. There was a trunk full of costumes and play clothes next to the tea table, and across from it, a cushioned rocking chair, suitable for any adult who might want to watch over the children as they played or read a bedtime story. Beside the window stood a magnificent 3-story dollhouse that was papered and carpeted and filled with everything a little girl's heart could desire. The night after the dollhouse was placed in the toy room, the wife awoke to the sound of tiny doors opening and shutting in the dollhouse. The rocking horse creaked. She thought she heard humming, happy humming. Slipping out of bed, she crept to the door, looked out into the toy room. The moonlight streamed through the window, and there she saw a doll floating just a few feet above the floor, as if it were being cradled in someone's arms, carried. The doll was carefully set in one of the small chairs at the tea table, and another doll soon joined it. Then a teddy bear in the third, and a moment later teacups were placed carefully in front of each guest. A fourth chair was pulled out, and a teacup lifted. to an invisible mouth. The wife could hear polite but indistinct chatter coming from the transparent hostess of the tea party. The meal ended, and the dolls were carefully returned to their places by the humming hostess. With a final affectionate pat on the rocking horse's head, the room became empty, save for the watching wife. After that night, the angry thumping ceased. There were no more unexplained messes. Anything that disappeared was easily attributed to her husband's refusal to wear his glasses except when he was reading. The wife got a picture of the little girl from the previous owner of the house and put it in a frame and placed it in the toy room. She never saw the ghost again. But occasionally, one of the unwound clocks would strike 7 times in a row. And once in a while, when no one else was around, she would hear a happy humming sound coming from the toy room.
Our guest today is Al Ridenour, author of Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas, which is a guide to a variety of sort of darker Christmas spirits. He has done extensive research for this book, as well as not just research as in going to the library and looking at old folk tales and folk legends, but he actually did a lot of good boots on the ground kind of research. So he knows whereof he speaks. We'd like to welcome him to the show. Al, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Glad to have you. I mentioned the boots on the ground thing. It's always good to establish credibility, I guess. You did a lot of research and traveling for this book, right? You went to, from what I counted, at least 15 different sites for this.
I wish I went to 15. Since then I've been involved since I started the book a little more. I visited Bavaria and Austria, a couple towns in each, but a lot of that research was actually done. When I went there, I didn't know for sure I was doing the book. And so a lot of the research was done sort of after the fact, chasing people down that I had a chance to talk to online. And also thanks to social media, a lot of these groups now have internet presences too. So a lot of, did a lot of surveys of groups online also. But I was lucky because I live in LA and we've had a number of just fortuitous contacts with people from areas that are particularly important to the Krampus practice. And in fact, I met cultural anthropologist who was at UCLA who happened to come to it just completely by chance, happened to be from the region that I particularly focus on in my book. So he was also really invaluable. So some boots to the ground, lots of online back and forth, and as you, of course, there's the other sort of library type research.
Mm-hmm. So it's a good sort of cornucopia of different types of research on Krampus. And I say Krampus, one of the things that you really bring out in this book, we in America, I think, have gotten really used to thinking of Krampus, just, you know, as a single one-form entity, this kind of horned devil, maybe with a big lolling tongue, shows up around Christmas time. And, you know, and even in saying we've gotten used to him, he's only really recently kind of made his resurgence into popular culture, but he's, you know, been lingering around here for quite a while. But even that's not exactly right, is it? The Krampus is not just Krampus, he's the Krampus, right?
Yes. Well, I guess the one reason I use the article, the is that's the practice in German, but it's also... Yeah, it's a species name in a sense. So the singular character is the comparison would be Dracula versus vampire, for instance. So the Krampus is a species like the vampire is. And usually when you talk about the folk practice where people dress up in these costumes, there are multitudes of these figures. So there are many of them, and they also vary regionally quite a bit. But they have. There have been a number of times throughout history, a few times throughout history, and it's happening continually now, where the sort of the image is stabilized. But it's relatively recent that it's kind of become a bit more uniform. The image that you describe, kind of beginning in the early 1900s, it started to stabilize, but. It's the figure of, you know, evolved from a whole family of creatures that have many points of commonality, but also many, you know, diversions from what we think of as the Krampus today.
Right. And interestingly, sort of in that wide sort of panoply, that variety of sort of Krampus-like species, what... So I do a lot of research on Krampus as well, and I tend to just call them the Christmas monsters,
yes.
Generally speaking. And so when I kind of look at those, you know, I see a lot of different, you know, you've got the Belschnickel, obviously, kind of where I am in Pennsylvania shows up. And you've got Chert over in the Czech Republic, which is kind of my first sort of entree into it. And you find these different iterations of it. But you actually do a really good job of casting that net a little wider. You draw in, for example, the Perksen, and you even find some connections to figures like La Befana. How did all that kind of come around?
Oh, believe me, I began the book with the idea that I would throw that net even wider, and then as I found, I attempt to contain the topic just because it can be so expansive to German speaking lands or the regions. So the Krampus per se is a creature of Bavaria and Austria, and it's spread. Thanks to the it spread during the years of the Austro-Hungarian Empire beyond those lands where it was native to further east and up in north into Germany where there's no image became familiar where there was no folk practice of costuming and going door to door. So I tried to keep close to Austria and Bavaria. And I also did dip into the other Alpine regions. There are in northern Italy, South Tyrol is what they call it, is a German-speaking region in Italy too. So I get into Italy, and some of these customs also were influenced by Italian carnival customs. So trying to just kind of draw some perimeters around what I was going to talk about was a bit of a challenge, but. The figures that you mentioned, the Persten figures, are they are Alpine, and they are the Krampus's closest relatives, most direct forebearers. And the La Befana character, the witch associated in Italy with Three Kings Day, is very much related to Frau Perste, who is a sort of embodiment of these Persten figures. Which are quite varied, and in recent years, let's say particularly the last 30 years, but In recent years, what is considered a parish is sort of, again, like the Krampus image, which has kind of become a bit more nailed down. But the parishion are, as understood today, look, you know, very much like the Krampus. And the primary difference, really, the only surefire way to tell them apart is when they appear. The Krampus appears on St. Nicholas Day, December 6th. And the parishion a month later on Three Kings Day, both of them are, of course, the eve of, and sometimes a little bit earlier and a little later. But the parishion work, I have a whole chapter on parishion practices and another chapter in the book devoted to Frau Persch and various witch-like figures like Befana and others that are part of the whole mythology. And that witchcraft thread is one of the oldest ones to trace back. It goes back to the 1100s.
That's fascinating. I think it's such an interesting aspect of the holiday to find surfacing is this. I mean, the holiday, everybody sort of describes this holiday season as, you know, magical, right? You hear people talk about it in popular culture. And it's interesting to see how deep that can go and how it's not just all, you know, the sweetness and light aspects of the magic. There are some darker folds to that cloth. So
absolutely.
And you uncover some really interesting practices. You talk about, you know, we think of when I think of the Krampus, obviously a lot of my work has been focused on this kind of Pennsylvania German experience where the Belschnickel, for example, goes around door to door and, you know, quizzes the children, punishes the naughty to some extent, gives out the treats, things like that. And obviously in Europe, the Krampus figures tend to accompany St. Nicholas, who does a lot more of the good and the reward. But the Krampus do a lot more than just kind of traveling door to door. For example, you have a whole section in your book on the Rempler, which I think is just fascinating. You found that in one of the towns that you were looking at. Is that correct?
Yes, that was the town I mentioned earlier, where my friend Mateus Rest is from, the anthropologist. That whole valley, there's a few little towns in the valley, like Gastein Valley. And it's really that is really restricted to that region. That region is the most traditional. The practice has been preserved in its purest form there, and some of what the traditional these outings by these Krampus troops, some of what made them traditional was they were kind of they're a little anarchic, a little they're wild, and in this area they've prevented these outings from becoming mere like civic spectacles. A lot of what Americans will see of the Krampuslauf, the Krampus run, is looks like a Halloween parade. And the one huge factor is there will be barrier setups separating spectators and performers, which is not anything, not the tradition at all. And if yes, the costume Krampuses will lean over the barriers and give little swats. But in these towns, in the towns in the Gastein Valley, the troops, there is no route, there is no map. They wander freely through the towns. And this is the origin of the Krampus Run. Basically, the core of the Krampus Run is the visit by St. Nicholas and his Krampuses, an angel, another helper figure, to private homes. So the Krampus Run, as we know it, basically evolved out of these troops crisscrossing the towns on their way to different homes, and that's the form it takes in these towns. And I mean, there are main thoroughfares that tend to have a lot of traffic where you'll see these groups going through, but it's uncharted, and it's also not organized by any. It's basically organized by teenage boys and 20-something boys, maybe a couple in their 30s, without any kind of community oversight. They are just following the tradition as they've learned it. And then one of the aspects of the tradition is a little bit of this tussle. The troops will get in. It's a ritualized thing now. And in the old days, you read about some of these outings by Nicholas performers. They called them back in the 1700s. They were parts of Nicholas plays, which are related but somewhat different. Or Persian. There's, you know, again, all of these sort of overlapping groups. But you read about some of these. Outings where these groups would meet, and there would actually be injuries and there were several cases actually fatalities. So some of this got very wild. Now, as the Rempler, which is what you the thing you initially were talking about, as that exists in the Gastein Valley, it's as I said, it's very ritualized. The two, each troop will have a Nicholas. They will each come forward when the troops meet on the road, and then the Nicholases will shake hands and then step aside and let the what basically it ends up being a shoving match between sometimes they designate a lead Krampus to do that, or sometimes it's a whole troop shoving until basically one gives, one falls down on the ground. And then it's ended with a ritual handshake by the two Krampuses, who will take their masks off, which is something they would never do if they were around the families they visit. But if it's just the two troops, they'll do that. Take their masks off, and then they wish each other with traditional saying that they say is to the good old ways, and then they part ways, and hopefully everything is resolved. There's no ill feeling. But so this is a sort of a polite, probably artifact of what used to be a much more wild confrontations.
It seems so, you know, it, for lack of a better term, sort of primitive in the sense that it seems like it's, you can feel the ancientness of something like that. Yeah. You can really feel that. And you even see it in other festival situations like Mardi Gras. They have the competing troops. But this is just so much more physical than that.
Well, it's very physical when you I did see, you know, I watched some of these when I was in that valley. And it's very visceral and very physical because you're out in the snow, and these suits are made out of animal hides, and they're wet, and they smell like wet barnyard animals. And, you know, the breath is steam. They're pushing each other, and their breath is steaming in the snowy air. And it feels very primal, very visceral.
Excellent. And, you know, I think there have been a lot of sort of anthropological speculations about the persistence of these festivals and sort of the meaning that gets ascribed to them. I know some people talk about them as sort of a ritual purification or something like that. What meaning did you sort of see for the towns that did these festivals?
I suppose that really depends on which customs we're talking about in particular. I think in general, you know, I think all of them function just as the sort of sort of carnivalesque outlet for it creates open space in the culture. Ironically, that even though the Krampus is supposed to be about about enforcing, you know, societies, you know, Catholic societies rules, what's really going on is the guys who are addressing as the Krampus are breaking all of the rules. You know, they're making a racket with the bells. They're disturbing the peace and keeping the old people awake. They're hitting people, which is not even in Austria is not acceptable on a public street. And they're scaring kids. And so they're living that out. And one of the sources I talked to, I mean, I kind of take a sort of psychological perspective on it, but one of the sources I was talking to, Wolfgang Böhm, who has I can't recall the name now, but he has a great photo book out on the Krampus. Anyway, he was pointing out to me that the age of the guys doing this, it corresponds with, you know, it's their years of it's their teenage years. It's their years where they're very unsettled, and it kind of gives them an outlet for, you know, to act out. I think there's something invigorating and kind of it brings kind of a youthful energy to the culture that it keeps that kind of teenage turbulence alive once a year. And, you know, people into their 20s and 30s can experience it. And, you know, these younger guys in Krampus costumes are, you know, they'll tussle with the 40-year-olds and so forth. So it kind of keeps the whole community kind of youthful and energized.
Right. And I mean, a lot of the men and boys who do participate, they tend not to be married yet. And that seems to be a fairly common thread.
Yes, some of the sources were a little, I'm just going to say shy about it, but my friend Matthias Rest, who is the anthropologist I've mentioned a couple of times, he was insistent there is a courtship aspect to this flirtation. I mean, basically, when I asked participants, you know, did they feel there was an aspect of flirtation? Some of them kind of hemmed and hawed, but the guys are hitting women. They're hitting the young girls, you know, in the town that they know. They're in disguise. It's very much the license of carnival. They have a mask and they can do what they kind of want to do all year round and smack the girls lightly to get their attention and chase them. And so, it's very much like a courtship aspect to it. And one of my other sources was, you know, he sort of fessed up to that. He put it in terms that Americans would understand. He said it's like when you're on a Krampus troop, it's like it's a masculinity thing. And it's like you're on the town's football team, so you have a certain kind of masculine status that you get from being on that troop.
I think I could weirdly get into being at my high school, you know, my high school Krampus troop much more than a high school football game.
Well, same here.
that's just me personally, though. And, you know, kind of tied into that with this idea of these young men before they are husbands and fathers. You mentioned the idea of, you know, the Krampuses going around and they're sort of scaring children. And I remember talking to one of the people who's very involved with the Philadelphia Krampuslauf. And one of the things that she pointed out that I've gone back to again and again and I love is that they generally don't actually have that many children crying at Krampuslauf. And very, very few of them do. But you see a lot more children crying on, you know, in line for Santa's lap at the mall. And I just think that's such an interesting dichotomy that if you give the children the opportunity to face the fear directly, you know, it's a different animal.
Yes, yes. I know Amber, who you're talking about with the Philadelphia Krampuslauf. She's great, and I know they especially are geared towards making their activity one that, you know, children can really enjoy. But you know, this is not. I think something that happens with, you know, just picturing like those kids standing in line waiting to see Santa. I think there is something. There's something in the environment. There's something in that setting that makes them tense. The setting of a Krampus run is the kids are kind of free to wander around and they're excited. Standing in line to see Santa is a whole different. It's kind of like standing in line to make your confession. It's a very different setting. But that's neither here nor there. I've seen kids in Munich. I had this one experience I keep coming back to. I've seen kids be, you know, really frightened by the Krampus, but I've seen that turn around in a way that is like really just kind of glorious for a parent, I'm sure. I was at one Krampuslauf and, I saw these, you know, the Krampuses were coming and I saw this little kid who was, with his parents and he was scared. He was visibly shaking actually. And, you know, you could just people standing around could see that. And his parents were pushing him forward. They're like, no, go ahead, you can do it. And you could tell he didn't want to, but as the Krampuses came up, the performers are, you know, I don't know, you know, in the old days it was probably different, but they are really sensitized to, you know, how much to push the kid, what kind of, you know, challenge he can accept. And so they got a little low, like you get down low when you shake a dog, you know, if you're approaching a dog you don't know, or you're trying to, not scare the kid. So they kind of made themselves a little less intimidating and reached out, and the kid took the Krampus's hand and he shook the Krampus's hand, and he just, you know, his face exploded with this big smile, and everyone around was smiling. I mean, everybody saw that the kid had done something important, you know, really important for his child. Maybe this kind of thing is important for the kid's life. He actually got to deal with the thing that scared him. And, you know, rather than being, you know, overly coddled or, you know, like muffled in some sort of safe space world, he dealt with something, and everyone felt the pride for him. And so I see it, the Krampus activities and those terms. It's not that they're not scary. They are scary. But I also because we also do Krampus events here in LA, and we dress up in costumes and we have kids come to the things, and the kids are, you know, you could see they get scared, and then they're so beaming. They're running around smiling. And we had the kids. We do a Krampus play. It's a traditional play, and one of the performers we have is a little girl, and she was terrified by the costumes. And then afterwards, she was running around smiling, telling everybody how terrified she was. And she was so proud to relate that. And she thought it was funny. She was scared. So you see that change take place. And it's a pretty really positive thing, I think.
I agree. It's part of that, that magic of the season sort of thing that we were talking about earlier. I think it happens at that sort of psychological level, and it's powerful.
Yeah.
You mentioned the work that you do in LA. You guys have it's a Krampus Nacht there, right?
Oh, we do quite a few things. we do a Krampus run, which isn't the traditional day is December 5th and maybe the 6th, but we do things all to be beginning actually. From the Thanksgiving weekend, I have been giving an annual lecture at the Goethe Institute, which is German American Cultural Institute out here. It's actually all over the country and world. I do a lecture in LA, and then we have a Krampus ball, which is sort of it's a costume party, but it's a first appearance of our Krampus troop. It's an indoor event, but the Krampus troop will invade, and we have that's fun for people. But we also have like traditional Bavarian dancers, music. So we try to keep it kind of authentic, but we'll mix it up with some crazy fun stuff too. And then we have, we do the Krampus run, in downtown LA. We have, people coming. We've had some guests from Austria. We had an entire troupe come in 2015, like a 12 person troupe. And we also have, some friends coming from the San Francisco area with, our Nicholas rides in a handmade steam car that one of our friends made. So the run's a big thing. And then we have another rock show, and we have our sort of Krampus themed rock show. And then we have the Nicholas play I just mentioned. It's like a traditional play from the 1900s from Austria that we translated, which really gives you a sense of kind of where it all comes from. Mm-hmm. So a whole series of events like running from late November through middle of December.
Ah, it's exciting. That would be definitely my sort of jam, as it were. But you guys don't do the don't do Krampus drag races like they do in Bloomington, do you?
Oh, I know that. Yeah, I know they have. What you mean, the drag the angels? I know they have some drag queen angels. Or
oh yeah, they do that. But I think there's a Krampus like an actual drag race that they do Krampus themed vehicles in Bloomington, Indiana.
That I hadn't heard of. I wonder if that's new. I had talked to her last year, but I didn't hear about that.
Oh. Yeah, somebody was telling me about that this year, and I was like, oh, I have to check that out. so exciting. One more question before I let you off the hook. I know you're recovering from an illness here, and I hate to drag you on too long, but
that sounds dramatic. I just have a little laryngitis. I don't want people sending me cards and letters.
Oh yes. Sorry, that's not anything like hopefully earth shattering or anything. But
we've come too close to the Krampus, and the darkness has claimed me.
You have been judged and found wanting. obviously, we talk about this, appearing in LA, it's appearing in Philadelphia and Indiana and Portland. It's growing popular here. It's growing. I think it's growing more popular in Europe as well, even though it's kind of always been there.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? What do you make of this increasing popularity of Krampus? Is there something about our culture today that needs it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the phenomenon in Europe and in the U.S. is different, because in Europe it has been a need to embrace the traditional that's kept it going, but in the U.S. I believe it's a desire to sort of redefine the holiday in an alternative way, and some of that. So I think our love of the Krampus is influenced by pop culture and cosplay and heavy metal, and it's very much a pop culture phenomenon, and that's influencing. I think that's just our technology and mass making technology or special effects technology, movies, comic books, that's spilling, and that also influences European culture. So we've, in some ways, it's become less of a traditionalist thing in Europe too. But I think even though people are, I think they look at it as a way to, I think the easiest way for Americans to look at it is they think, oh, I'm not going to celebrate mom and dad's, grandma and grandpa's Norman Rockwell Christmas, but what can I do? What can I still want a tradition. And So it's become, it serves that purpose very neatly. And Halloween has been an I think the like sales for Halloween merchant, costumes and all of the plethora of Halloween haunts and events that pop up. It's a growing industry. So you sort of see these things bleeding together. But what's ironic is that's how it's always been. I mean, if you go back a few centuries, that Christmas that we know is like, it was already being, it was already sort of a fabrication in the Victorian era. They were assessing their own traditions in a way that was not quite, it was making things out to be older than they were, that were actually new. This dark Christmas that I write about in the book, we're talking about the 1100s and sort of an attitude towards Christmas that, beginning with some very dark Christmas liturgical plays that, with the Massacre of the Innocents and portrayals of the Christian Catholic plays held, produced around Christmas would often present the end of the world scenarios. So there's always been, even, there's always been this sort of dark aspect of Christmas for centuries that, only really recently has been has been neglected. Not that it hasn't been a time of, light and joy too, but I think so. Basically, even people in their search for something alternative are coming back to something that, know it or not, is actually quite traditional. And I think there's just some basic kind of primal thing that must satisfy too. Definitely. I think it's the only way to account for it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we even have the idea of, ghost stories being told at Christmas and things like that. I think you're right. It's always been there. It's just interesting to see it kind of coming back.
Yeah.
The way it is. Well, Al, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating and enlivening conversation. If people want to find out more about you, more about your work, where can they do that?
They can reach me through the website we use for Krampus activities here. It's just KrampusLosAngeles.com. So if any email sent through that will go to me.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Our guest today has been Al Ridenour, author of The Krampus and The Old Dark Christmas, Roots and Rebirth of the Folkloric Devil. Thank you so much for being with us today, Al.
Thank you so much.
The Headless Haint, a ghost story of Madison, North Carolina. A man and his wife were going along the big road. It was cold, and the road was muddy and sticky red. Their feet was muddy nigh froze off, and they was hungry, and they got pitch dark before they got where they was going. Twan long before they came to a big, fine house with smoke coming out of the chimney and a fire shining through the window. It was the kind of house rich folks lives in. So they went round to the back door and knocked on the back porch. Somebody said, "Come in." They went in. They didn't see nobody. They looked all up and down and all around, but they still didn't see nobody. They saw fire on the hearth with a skillet sitting in it, all ready for supper to be cooked in them. They saw there was meat and flour, lard, sausage, a pot of beans smoking, and a rabbit a-boiling in the covered pot. But still, they didn't see nobody. They saw everything was ready for somebody. The woman took off her wet shoes and stockings to warm her feet at the fire, and the man took the bucket and lit out for the spring house to get fresh water for some coffee. They allowed they was going to have them some brown beans and a Molly Cottontail, and some cornbread and hot coffee, and three shakes. The woman was toasting her feet, and right through the shut door in walks a man, and he don't have no head. He had on his breeches and his shoes and his galoshes and his vest and his coat and his shirt and his collar, but he don't have no head, just a raw neck and a bloody stump. And he started to tell the woman, without no mouth with which to tell her, how he happened to come in that way. She might have not jumped out her skin, but she said, "What in the name of the Lord do you want?" So he said, "He's in an awful misery, being dead and buried in two pieces. He said somebody killed him for his money, and took him to the cellar and buried him in two pieces, one his head in one place, and his corpse in another. He said them robbers dug all around trying to find his money. When they didn't find it, they went off and left him in two pieces, and now he hankers to be put back together so as to get rid of his misery." Then the haint said some other folks had been there and asked what he wanted, but they didn't say in the name of the Lord, because she did, is how come he could tell her about the misery. About that time, the woman's husband came back from the spring house with a bucket of water to make the coffee and set the bucket up on the shelf. Then he saw the haint, with the bloody joint of his neck sticking up and come nigh to jumping out of his skin. The wife told the haint who her husband is, and the haint began at the start, told the whole thing over again about how come he is the way he is. He told him if they come down to the cellar and find his head and bury him all in one grave, he'd make him rich. They said they would. They got a torch. The haint said, "Don't need no torch." And he went up to the fire and stuck his finger in it, and it blazed up like light would not. And he led the way down to the cellar by the light. They went a long way down the steps before they came to the cellar. Then the haint said, "Here's where my head's buried at. Over here's where the rest of me's buried. Now you all dig right over yonder where I throw this spot of light, and dig till you touch my barrels of gold and silver money." So they dug and dug, and sure enough, they found the barrels of money he'd covered up with a thick cellar floor. Then they dug up the haint's head and hissed the thing on the spade. The haint just reached over and picked up his head and off of the spade and put it on his neck. Then he took off his burning finger and stuck it in a candlestick on a box. And holding his head, he crawled back into the hole that he'd come out of. And from under the ground, they heard him saying, "Y'all can have my land. Can have my house, you can have all my money and be rich as I was, because you buried me in one piece together, head and corpse." Then they took the candlestick, blazing with the haint's finger, went back upstairs and washed themselves with a lye soap. Then the woman made up the cornbread with the spring water and greased the skillet with hog meat, and put in a hoe cake, lifted the lid, put coals of fire on top of the lid and around the edges of the skillet, and cooked the hoe cake good and done. Her man put the coffee and water in the pot and set it on the trivet to boil. Then they had that supper of them. They had them beans and that rabbit and that hoe cake and that hot coffee. And they lived there all their lives, had barrels of money to buy victuals and clothes with. And they never heard no more about the man that had come upstairs without no head where his head ought to be.
Thank you.
Well, that will just about do it for us for this evening. I hope that you have enjoyed this brief tour through darkness, I guess. I don't know. I hope that the winter season is treating you well. And importantly, I hope that you are enjoying your time with friends and family, if that's what you're doing, that you're enjoying whatever festive holiday traditions most suit you, that you're finding a little bit of magic in the season. But also that, as we've discussed here in this episode, that you're making a little space for that darkness too. It's important, I think, to have at least some balance, and it's a good time of year to enjoy a little bit of being scared and a little bit of things that go bump in the night, a little bit of what lurks in the darkness, and then to also have the light aspect to counterbalance that. So, at any rate, I really want to thank our guest, Al Ridenour, for being with us tonight, and also tell you that you can find information on the stories you've heard in our show notes. They are taken from folklore, so you'll be able to find the books that I specifically used to reference those tales, and go read them yourself. There's lots more where that came from. So, at any rate, if you have spooky, scary ghost stories, particularly holiday-themed ones, I would love to hear them. Please feel free to email them into us, compassandkey@gmail.com. Let us know if we can share them. That's something that we very much like to do, share the stories our listeners send in. And if you do want to, if you are okay with us sharing them, then let us know kind of what name you would like us to reference, if you want to go by a pseudonym or something like that. You can also find us at our website, newworldwitchery.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We have a page at Pinterest as well called The Old Broom. You can obviously also always find us on Patreon, patreon.com/newworldwitchery, where you can throw a buck a month our way, get some neat rewards in the process of that as well. Any support you can give is appreciated. If you can't support financially, we totally get that. We also super appreciate people who leave us reviews on iTunes or Stitcher or other places where podcasts are found. Or just share this around with your friends and loved ones, or even your enemies if you think it will smite them in some way. We appreciate any sharing that you can do. So that will about do it for us. So for this 2016 Yuletide season, this is Corey bidding you farewell, adieu, happy holidays, and Gruß von Krampus. All right? Thanks for listening. Be well.
New World Witchery exists because of the support and generosity of our sponsors.
We would especially like to thank our producer-level sponsors, Diana Garino, Renee Otters,
Ye Old Magic Shop, Raven Darkmoon,
Little Wren, The Witch's View Podcast,
Momacera, Molly,
Jen Rue of Rue and Hyssop, Athena Beth,
Catherine, Corvus,
Michael, Shannon,
Jessica, Victoria,
Daniel, and Jonathan.
Thank you all so much for your ongoing support.
If you'd also like to help us out and become a patron, visit patreon.com/newworldwitchery.